person with an argument. How can someone argue with an experience? Your story is your story, and no one can take that away. Don't be ashamed to share it. As Paul wrote, people will be comforted by hearing about the comfort you received in God. Overcome apathy. Some people don't struggle with fear or shame, but they do struggle with apathy. Actually, they probably don't struggle with it because apathy by definition means not caring. So they just give in to their apathy. Apathy can be defined as passion removed. It means indifference, coldness, lack of feeling about something. I started this chapter talking about passion, so I've come full circle here. Without a passion for Jesus, you won't be motivated to share about him with others. Passion is a product of knowledge and experience. The more you know Jesus, the more you understand what he's done for you, and the more you realize how much he can do for hurting people around you, the more motivated you will be to make yourself uncomfortable so others can be comforted. There was a photographer named Kevin Carter who went to the Sudan in 1993 to document the war and famine taking place there. The horrors he witnessed were unimaginable, but his photographs helped bring awareness in other nations and spur people to action. On one occasion, Carter came across a tiny child on the brink of starvation. The child was emaciated, whimpering, attempting to crawl toward a feeding center. Suddenly, a vulture landed nearby. The photographer had been told not to touch victims because of the threat of disease, so he simply took photographs of the heart-wrenching scene. Finally, he scared the bird off and watched as the child crawled toward the center, then lit a cigarette, prayed, and wept. The New York Times ran the photo. Readers around the world wrote and called, asking what happened to the child. Carter had to reply that he did not know. He didn't pick up the child. He didn't carry the child to safety. He simply watched from the sidelines. Carter won a Pulitzer Prize for the photo. It became an iconic image of the horrors of the Sudan famine. But the darkness of that moment and others like it never left him. He committed suicide 3 months after winning the Pulitzer Prize. He wrote, "I am haunted by vivid memories of killings and corpses and anger and pain." Carter brought awareness to the problem, but not aid. I can't criticize him. We've all been guilty of watching from a distance and not doing anything. At least Carter was on the front lines. At least he was invested and aware. But it wasn't enough, and it haunted him. I don't want to be known as the generation that brings awareness, but not solutions. We are in danger of becoming the generation that Instagrams about issues, that tweets about travesties, but that does nothing personally to change them. Are we reporters or rescuers? Are we activists or slacktivists? Will we set down the camera, pick the child up, and save a life? I'm not referring just to political or social issues, although those are important. I'm talking about our relationship to the world at large. Will we step up and assume our responsibility as Jesus followers to help people in whatever capacity we can? I am grateful that God is not apathetic. Really, that's the point of this book. That's what I mean by friend of sinners. God isn't passively observing the plight of humanity. He is actively involved. He sent his son to die for us. He hears our prayers. He gives us aid. He is preparing a place for us, and one day he will return to take us to heaven. The book of Isaiah has been called a Bible in miniature. It has 66 chapters. The first 39 chapters are primarily about judgment. But starting in chapter 40, the focus turns to the comfort and salvation found in the coming Messiah. Similarly, the Bible has 66 books. The first 39, the Old Testament, focus on the law and God's mercy. Then, starting with the birth of Jesus, the New Testament focuses on the fulfillment of the law and on salvation through the blood of Jesus. Jesus is the Messiah, the promised Comforter, whom God has sent for our salvation. Look again at what Isaiah wrote in chapter 40, verse 11. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those that have young. God's love and concern for humanity are clear. He longs to carry and comfort hurting individuals. Why are we passionate about people? Because God is passionate about people, and because God is passionate about us. Will you consider making yourself uncomfortable to bring comfort to others? Will you allow God to replace fear, shame, or apathy with his passion for people? I promise you, the reward is worth the risk. You have answers. You have hope. You have healing. It's time to share it with the world. Chapter 10, How to Be Great. Have you ever noticed we all want to be great? We might have different definitions of greatness, and we might have different goals and dreams, but none of us wants to be average or second best. We want to be important. We want our lives to matter. The search for greatness is a normal part of human existence. When you go shopping, you don't look for average clothes. You look for the best. Best fashion, best value, best quality. When you eat at a restaurant, you don't ask the server, could you recommend a really average dish? I'm in the mood for something kind of blah. You ask which dish is the best because you want an amazing dining experience. When you go to a movie, you don't look up reviews and find the most mediocre film available. You look for the movie that critics are raving about and people love. We look for the best we can get because we desire greatness. I grew up as a preacher's kid, as I mentioned earlier. My father is my hero, but he's one of those scary preachers. He has a heart of gold, but he has eyes that see into your soul. When he looks at you, it's like he can tell what you did Friday night. When I was growing up in Tacoma, Washington, my dad was a well-known figure in the town. He wasn't just known for his preaching, though. He was also known for being absolutely passionate at his kids' sports events. It was as if he turned into another person. A hidden side of his personality would burst through, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He was that parent, the one that out-cheered or out-yelled, depending on the score, every other parent. I remember one particular basketball game. I think I was in the 7th grade, and I was on the junior varsity squad. I was having a terrible game. I was missing shots and rebounds, and I kept getting called for fouls. I racked up 4 fouls, one away from fouling out. I could just tell by glancing at my dad he was about to lose it. Then it happened. I tried to block a shot, and the ref blew his whistle and signaled a foul against me. That was when my dad lost it. It was like righteous anger started to come all over him. I didn't know if it was the Spirit of God or something else. It was hard to tell. "Ref," he yelled, "are you blind? That was a horrible call. You're a terrible referee." Everyone in the stands looked at my dad. They all heard him clearly, and so did the referee. I'll never forget what happened next. It was burned into my adolescent brain. The referee looked at my dad and yelled, "Pastor, you're out of here." My dad, Reverend Wilkerson, was ejected from the game. I was embarrassed, but it was also kind of awesome. I remember thinking, why does my dad care this much? Why does he get so passionate about 7th grade JV game? I discovered the answer a couple of years ago. I was back in Washington State visiting my older brother, John Fulton. He has a daughter named Israel, who was 2 years old at the time. One afternoon, John Fulton asked me, "Rich, do you want to go with me to Israel's swim lesson?" "Absolutely," I said. We got to the swim lesson, and Israel got in the water with about 15 other kids. All of a sudden, something came over me. It was the same spirit that hit my dad. I began to freak out. I yelled, "Come on, Israel! You can do it! You are God's chosen one! You're the next Olympic champion!" My brother looked at me and said, "Rich, what's wrong with you? This is just a swim lesson." I said, "Swim lesson? Come on, man. She's in the water, and there are other kids. This is a race, and she has to be first. She has to be the best. She has to be great." In the middle of flipping out, it hit me. I've become my father. Whether we admit it or not, down deep, we all want to be in first place. We all want to be great. Even in our walk with God and our spiritual journey, none of us prays, "God, make me average." The problem, though, is often we don't know the correct path to greatness. We try to achieve greatness the wrong way. This isn't just a 21st century problem. Even Jesus' disciples had wrong ideas about greatness. The Gospel of Mark records a conversation where Jesus addressed their quest to be great, and what he told them can teach us a lot today. They came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" But they kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, Anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all. He took a little child whom he placed among them. Taking the child in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me." Chapter 9, verses 33 through 37. Road trips. Jesus and his disciples were on a road trip. Road trips, especially when the car is full, are both awesome and agonizing. They have a unique effect on your psyche. If you ever took trips like these as a kid, you can probably relate. We did a lot of them, always in the stereotypical minivan, and I'm still scarred. Being in close proximity to the same people for extended periods of time tends to reveal immaturities and insecurities you didn't know you had. The trip always starts out great. You have plenty of snacks, someone puts on a cool playlist, the windows are down, and the vibe is amazing. What could go wrong? About 500 miles, that's what goes wrong. Sometime in the middle of nowhere, when the AC isn't working, you haven't slept well, and you haven't been able to find a bathroom for hours, fallen human nature makes an appearance. It starts with impatience and complaints. Are we there yet? No. How much farther? Hours. Lots of hours. Stop asking. When you realize the trip is nowhere close to over, your attention turns from the road outside to the company inside. You start to argue with your siblings. You get irritated at your friends. You wonder whose idea it was to take this road trip from hell. But then, eventually, you make it to some sliver of civilization. You fill your tank and stomach, empty your bladder, and the trip becomes fun again. Then the cycle repeats. That's more or less the situation with the disciples. Somewhere along the hot, dusty road, they got into an argument about who was the greatest. Maybe it started with Simon the Zealot taking offense at some random comment by Peter the loudmouth. Then people took sides, and the whole thing escalated into a clash of opinions and personalities. From there, everyone started talking about themselves, the people they had helped, the miracles they had done, the time they had spent with Jesus, and so on, trying to prove how important they were. It's easy to criticize these 12 guys, but we do the same thing on our spiritual journey. The road is long, the process is arduous, and at some point we start to ask God, are we there yet? How much farther until I reach my destiny? When will I find significance and recognition? When will I be great? We want immediate greatness, but we don't want the process. And yet greatness is more about the journey than the destination. And it's more about the people you are traveling with than the place you are traveling to. You don't arrive at greatness, by the way. It's not some tangible, measurable goal. A six-figure salary, a million Twitter followers, a house on the beach. Greatness is who you are, not what you do. And the journey is what polishes and perfects that within us. We are on a journey with Jesus. It's a lifelong journey, and it will have high moments and low moments. We tend to be so enamored by the highlights. We love ESPN because it just shows us the highlights, the best moments. They never show the hours of practice, yet it's the hours of anonymity that produce those seconds in the spotlight. Our road trip with Jesus is not about the highlights. It's about his presence in the process. That is more important than where we've been or what we've done. In the journey of life, we don't just complain about not being there yet. We also tend to argue with other people about petty things. We want our voices to be heard, our feelings to be validated, our opinions to be respected. Can we all agree the disciples' debate over greatness was a bit ridiculous, considering the context? The disciples had Jesus at their side. Jesus is the Messiah, the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, the author and finisher of their faith, the King of Kings. I could go on, but you get the point. Yet they were bickering about which of them was the greatest. In comparison to Jesus, it was a moot point. Christians are notorious for arguing over dumb things, for getting frustrated over things Jesus never got frustrated over, for spending time on things Jesus never spent time on, for getting offended about things Jesus never got offended about. We are on a journey. We have Jesus in our car. He is the hero of heroes, the legend of legends. He breathes stars into existence. Can you do that? And yet we look at each other and start discussing who is the greatest. What do you do? Where do you go on vacation? What car do you drive? What's your ministry? How big is your church? How important are you to God? We get lost in labels and categories that are meaningless in comparison to Jesus. A pastor came up to me at a conference not too long ago. He was really concerned. He said, "Rich, what does VU Church believe about the end times?" I said, "What do you mean? We believe Jesus is coming back." He said, "Yes, but what do you believe about the rapture? Are you pre-tribulation, mid-tribulation, or post-tribulation?" I didn't know how to reply. I didn't want to hurt his feelings, but I was not interested in where this conversation was going. There is little benefit in arguing over the chronology of events that we don't really understand and haven't happened yet. I would rather talk about how Jesus came to seek, befriend, and save sinners. I'd rather talk about God's grace and love. I'd rather work together to reach our cities for Jesus. That excites me far more than debating the beasts of the apocalypse. Why do we care so much that our opinions be heard, that people agree we are right? I find that focusing on Jesus keeps my ego in check. The disciples veered from that, and their arguing about greatness was ridiculous. It was then, and it is now. Striving and competing to be great in the eyes of others is pointless because we have Jesus with us. We need to keep our eyes on Him. His presence, His love, and His grace are far more important than our egos. When I am tempted to compare myself to others, to compete with others, or to let insecurity rise in my heart, the best antidote is to look to Jesus. The greatness Jesus modeled puts our lives and desires in perspective. It's good to be great. Jesus didn't interfere. He let them argue and bicker along the way, but when they got to Capernaum, He called them together for a little chat. It's important to note Jesus did not criticize their desire for greatness. He did not rebuke them for wanting to be great. That is significant because sometimes we think our desire for greatness is wrong in itself, that it's prideful, selfish, or superficial. We desire greatness because we were created for greatness. It's a God-given desire, not a sinful desire. It's inherent in humanity, as I said earlier. God put within us an impulse to be the best we can be and to achieve the most we can achieve. We were designed to reach our potential. We were created in the image of a God who is great, so it's logical to sense greatness within ourselves. Jesus didn't criticize their desire to be great. Rather, He completely redefined the pathway to greatness. It's not wrong to be great, but it's wrong to try to be great the wrong way. The disciples and many of us were confused about the pathway to greatness. That is understandable because we live in a fallen, confused world. Sin has entered the equation, and the enemy, the devil, seeks to steal, kill, and destroy all that is good. He isn't creator, he is destroyer. So all he can do to derail God-given desires is manipulate the pathway to fulfill them. Our positive, healthy desire for greatness can be twisted into something that hurts us and others if we don't understand God's definition of greatness and His path to achieve it. How do we define being great? What does it mean? And how do we achieve it? I see two frequent misconceptions we need to correct. Tell me I'm great. It's not wrong to want to be great. The problem arises when we want to be known as great. We think greatness means being known as great. That's the first misconception we need to debunk. We need to think our greatness is connected to who recognizes us, who congratulates us, who thanks us. We fall victim to the approval of others. We believe that unless we are popular or noticed, we aren't doing anything great. We find ourselves striving, discontented, looking for peace. Instead of thinking, I want to be the best I can be, we start to think, I need people to know how great I am. The more known we are, the greater we think we are. That's why we are obsessed with Instagram. Who liked my photo? How many followers do I have? Who knows me? In VU Church, we started to run into a problem. We couldn't find enough volunteers to staff the parking lot. We had lots of people who wanted to help in different areas, but no one was excited about the parking lot. Why? Because there's no glory in the parking lot. It's hot in the parking lot. You get yelled at in the parking lot. Demons manifest in the parking lot. People flip you off in the parking lot. Nobody knows your name. Nobody recognizes you. Nobody thanks you. They either ignore you or try to run you over. There's never a shortage of people willing to serve on stage, But the real test of servant heart is whether you can serve when no one knows you. If serving in obscurity is beneath you, leadership in public is beyond you. Greatness is not about who knows you. You can't live your life for other people. You live for the audience of one, and his name is Jesus Christ. You may never receive the recognition you deserve on earth, but the God of heaven knows you, loves you, and believes in you. I'm greater than you. The second misconception is that greatness means being better than everyone around us. Instead of running our own race, we look to the left and the right. As long as we're ahead of those close by, we think we're great. It's the comparison trap. We make greatness relative. It's conditional based on the performance of other people. The problem is, you might be the best some of the time, but you won't be the best all the time. When you make other people your standard, you set yourself up for failure. It's not sustainable. It's not objective, and it's not healthy. Comparison is a thief. It steals your contentment and your motivation. Comparison works like a scoreboard. When we do good, we think God loves and accepts us more. When we do bad, we think he loves us less. So we are constantly sizing ourselves and other people up, trying to be better than others in God's eyes. That's not how God thinks, though, and it's not how grace works. We are already accepted and loved and called, and nothing can change that. We each have our own lives to live, our own races to run. God doesn't give us grace to do what other people are called to do, and if we try to run their race, we will only frustrate ourselves. If you feel paralyzed in life, maybe you are more focused on the runners around you than on the race before you. There's a story in the Bible about a shepherd boy named David who became the most famous king in Hebrew history. One time, before he was king, he tried to wear Saul's armor in a one-on-one battle against an invading army's champion soldier, a giant named Goliath. The armor wasn't designed for David, though, and it didn't fit him. He couldn't even move while he was wearing it. The thing meant to protect him ended up paralyzing him. He ended up taking it off and facing the giant with nothing but the sling and stones he was used to using as a shepherd, and he won a resounding victory. David wasn't supposed to face his battles the same way others around him faced theirs. He had his own abilities, his own path, his own wins to pursue. Comparison is the enemy of progress. It's a recipe for pride, mediocrity, and frustration. Life isn't about beating other people. It's about being the best we can be. We need a vision from God of who we are and what we can accomplish, and then we need to run our own race, fixing our eyes only on Jesus. Last is the new first. The disciples were arguing about greatness, but what they really wanted was a purpose. That's what our arguments and striving usually come down to. We are trying to find our place, our calling, our role. Our real need isn't prominence, it's significance. Jesus understood something his 12 followers needed to know. Their purpose was found in how they related to other people. They would find the greatness they were looking for not by being known as great or by being greater than others, but by serving others. Remember, Jesus was the friend of sinners. That was what motivated him. That was what excited him. He wanted his disciples to understand the connection between greatness and love. They needed to see the true greatness is always about other people. Once we meet the friend of sinners, we are called to be friends of sinners. And the best way to be a friend is to serve. He told them, anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all. Mark chapter 9, verse 35. Jesus was saying that in God's economy, last is the new first. The way up is down. The way to the top is to be at the bottom. The servant is the leader, and the leader is the servant. It's the paradox of the gospel. If you want to be first, you have to be willing to be last. I've always loved the phrase, there's room at the bottom. Maybe you think, there's too much competition around me. I feel like I'm bumping into people. Nobody knows what I'm doing. I can't seem to get myself out there, to get ahead, to catch a break. Trust me, There's plenty of room at the bottom. If your goal is to serve, to love, and to help, there is more than enough opportunity for you. You will always have a place because few people think like that. The last become first because God's ways are not the world's ways. For a while, the people who push and fight, who promote themselves, who step on the little guy to get ahead, might seem to be way ahead of the pack. But Jesus has a way of inverting everything. At some point, we realize the people who seem to be making such great progress are going in the wrong direction. God is going in a different direction. He has different priorities and a different path. Sooner or later, the people who appeared to be at the back, the people who served and gave and loved, end up with what everyone wanted all along: significance, fulfillment, value, peace. When we understand we are called to serve others, we discover purpose and significance. Instead of focusing on seizing opportunities, we focus on serving people. Instead of looking for what we can get, we look for who we can help. Instead of holding on to our lives, we give them up, knowing the God we have entrusted everything to is faithful. Instead of finding contentment in accomplishments or titles, we find it in a person, in Jesus, and in serving the people he loves. When we embrace service, even our pain starts to make sense. We realize our wounds can become someone else's wisdom. Our hurts can become someone else's healing. Our breakdown can become someone else's breakthrough. If we want to be great, we have to be willing to be the least. We have to be willing to be unknown. That is hard to do because fame and accolades are exciting. They appeal to our pride. They stroke our egos and they prop up our insecurities. But ultimately, they are a fickle friend and a false hope. True greatness is not measured by who knows our name or who we're ahead of. It's measured by the impact we have on the lives of others. Greatness is about giving, not receiving. It's about others, not us. What's great about greatness is that it's accessible to everyone. If greatness meant being known or being the best, then only a few people could achieve it. But if greatness is the result of service, then greatness is within all of us. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. summed it up perfectly when he said, "Everybody can be great because everybody can serve." Servant leadership is our calling and identity as Jesus followers. Jesus said this about himself: "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Mark chapter 10, verse 45. Jesus used an object lesson to make his point about servant leadership clear to his disciples. He called a child over to the group and sat him down. He said, "Anyone who welcomes a little child like this on my behalf welcomes me. And anyone who welcomes me welcomes not only me, but also my Father who sent me." Mark chapter 9, verse 37, New Living Translation. What was he saying? That if they wanted to be great, they had to welcome children. They had to serve children. Until they welcomed a child, they hadn't truly welcomed Jesus. Recently, I was studying and writing by the pool. Don't hate me. That's how we do it in Miami. Best city in the world. And while I studied, I couldn't help but notice a father who had his three small boys with him at the pool. The oldest boy was maybe about 4 years old, and the other two were twins and were about three. None of the boys knew how to swim. The guy had his hands full, to put it mildly. He seemed stressed out. When it was time for them to go, I could tell he was bracing himself for a long ordeal. He started with the oldest. "Cody, time to get out of the pool." "No, Dad, I want to swim." "No, time to get out. Come on, bud. Over here. 1, 2. So Cody climbed out, not happy at all about the situation. His dad took him to a chair, wrapped him in a towel, and told him to stay there. I could see the dad checking the kids off in his mind. 1 down, 2 to go. He called the next kid. "Tommy, time to get out." "But Dad," Tommy said, "I want to keep swimming." Right then, Cody zipped past his dad. He had a toy in his hand, and he threw it as far out as he could into the pool, and it looked like he was about to jump in after it. "Cody, you don't know how to swim." The dad grabbed him. "Get back from the edge. Go sit down." He turned back to the pool. "Tommy, out now." Tommy got out, also unhappy. "Okay, Tommy, go sit with Cody over there on the chair. Cody, get back to the chair. Cody, Tommy, sit with Cody. They both sat down. All right, two down, one to go. He called to the last child. Zach, come on. Get out of the water. Tommy, stop. Cody, sit down. Zach, come on. I said, Tommy, sit there. Cody, put your swimsuit back on. We're in public. Zach, now. The dad had to use both arms and legs to corral all three kids. The whole ordeal lasted 25 minutes. I probably should have prayed for him or at least shouted encouragement, but I was too fascinated and terrified. Eventually, he got them wrapped in towels and out of the gate. Something hit me while I watched them. That father saved his kids' lives at least 17 times. He protected them, saved them, and served them, and they never said thank you. Not even once. Actually, it was the opposite. They got mad. They threw fits. They tossed their toys back in the pool just to be obnoxious. They disobeyed. I believe Jesus pulled a child into the story to give the disciples and us a practical illustration of servant leadership. A child can't repay you. A child won't thank you. A child will never mention you on Instagram. A child can't help you back. Many times when you serve a child, he or she resists it. What was Jesus saying? That true greatness comes from serving people who will never notice, never thank you, never honor you, never give anything back. They might resist you and criticize you. They might get mad at you. As I sat by the pool, though, I felt the Holy Spirit speak to me. Rich, that's what you look like sometimes. You are like those boys. I started to think how many times I've run back to the pool, determined and desperate to do my own will. How many times has Jesus rescued me, protected me, helped me? And I don't usually say thank you. If anything, I resist his limits and resent his commands. Isn't that the picture of the gospel? Jesus loved us and died for us when we were still his enemies. He is the friend of sinners and the servant of sinners. Jesus isn't asking us to do something he hasn't done. He is the greatest person to have ever lived, yet he is the servant of all. Now he is calling us to serve those he loves so much. He's calling us to help those who might resist our help, might resent us, and will probably never repay our kindness. He is asking us to stop fixating on fickle, temporary, petty pursuits and instead invest our lives in what really matters. People. Help desk. A few years ago, my wife and I were at the airport in Bali, Indonesia. We were trying to find our gate, but no one spoke English. I was starting to panic a little. Then a minor miracle. We came across a kiosk that had help desk written on it in English. There was a nicely dressed woman sitting behind the counter. I ran up to the desk. Excuse me, ma'am. Could you help me? She looked at me. Then she looked past me. But she didn't say a word. I was a bit confused, but I didn't give up easily. I said it again, more loudly this time. Ma'am, could you please help me? She looked back at me. Then she looked past me again. I couldn't believe it. She was completely ignoring me. I was a little upset at this point. Ma'am, I'm lost. I'm desperate. Could I please get some help here? No response. She just stared blankly into the distance. I was really mad now. Tantri said, babe, calm down. I replied with righteous anger and holy zeal. She's at the help desk. This is her job. A woman walking by saw the commotion and walked over to us. Sir, do you need assistance? She speaks English. There is a God, I thought. Yes, I said, I need help finding my gate. So I came to the help desk because I can't seem to get any help. I was emphasizing the word help because clearly someone wasn't doing her job. The woman who approached me began speaking to the woman behind the desk in another language. Then she turned back to me. Sir, this woman doesn't speak English. And sir, she doesn't work here. She's just sitting here. I remember thinking, that's not okay. Why would you sit behind a desk that says help desk if you can't help me? Then it hit me. How many Christians take on the title of Jesus follower? But when the world looks for help, we don't speak their language and we aren't on duty. Too often we are so distracted by our pursuit of greatness that we forget true greatness is simply helping people. They are standing before us, lost and hurting, desperate for help. They are looking to us for answers. After Jesus went back to heaven, and in the years before Christians became known as Christians, Jesus' followers were simply said to be a part of the way. Jesus said he was the way, the truth, and the life. John chapter 14, verse 6. The way to what? To true joy, fulfillment, peace, greatness, salvation. We need to see ourselves as people of the way. We are followers of Jesus, and we know the way to him. We are called to find the broken, the hurting, and the disenfranchised. We are called to be their friends. We are called to serve them and to love them the way Jesus serves and loves us. The path to greatness is service. We can't save anyone, but we can serve everyone. And as we serve them, Jesus will save them. And as we love them, Jesus will heal them. As we bless them, Jesus will build them. We aren't the answer, but we know the answer. Our calling is to serve people by showing them the way to Jesus. All of us can be great because all of us can serve. Epilogue. Love betrayed. Years ago, American Airlines gave me Emerald status. I guess it was their way of thanking me for spending large portions of my life trapped in a tube at 30,000 feet. At the time, I had no idea what Emerald status meant. I just assumed I would get more frequent flyer miles or something. Then someone who heard about it mentioned, hey, if you're ever in Melbourne, you should check out the Qantas First Class Lounge. I've flown through Melbourne quite a bit, but I had never heard of this lounge. I said, I don't usually fly first class, so I don't think I have access to that. They wouldn't let me in. My friend assured me, yes, they will. You are Emerald status, man. You have access. A few months later, I happened to fly through Melbourne with my friend Phil. I said, Phil, I just remembered there's something called the Qantas First Class Lounge here. Let's go see if we can get in. It could be fun. Phil said, I don't know. We aren't in first class, but yeah, let's give it a go. We started following these small discreet signs through the airport. It was like a maze. There were stairs, elevators, and hallways. Finally, we came to a set of nondescript closed doors. A tiny sign above said, Qantas, First Class Lounge. We were feeling a bit timid, but as we approached the doors, they suddenly swung open. We walked into a beautiful lobby, as far removed from the airport as heaven is from hell. There was a man behind the desk with a perfect smile and perfectly coiffed hair. He was so well-groomed, he looked fake. I said, sir, I've been told we have access to this lounge. He said, let me see your ticket. He checked my ticket. He typed something into his computer. He looked up at my face, then down at his screen, then up at me again. Then he smiled and said, Mr. Wilkerson, sir, we've been waiting for you. Enter at your leisure. And he gestured inside. Phil and I walked into the next room, and it was indeed heaven on earth. There were white leather couches. There was mood lighting. Art was hanging on the walls. There was free internet. We even found a restaurant inside with a full breakfast menu. I glanced over it. My mouth watered. Eggs Benedict, Belgian waffles, bacon. I tried to find the prices, but oddly, there were none listed. Then it hit me. It was all free. This place was unbelievable. I looked at Phil and said, Phil, isn't this crazy? All these years I've been coming to Melbourne. All the times I've been in this airport, I could have had access to this room. I could have been getting free bacon. I had no idea. Right then I felt God speak to me. Rich, that's what people do. They have access to heaven's throne, but some of them don't know that, and others don't believe that, so they stay outside. They are all welcome. They can enter at their leisure because Jesus is the way to me. So often people try to do life alone. They believe in God, and they might even pray to God, but for some reason they think he is not on their side. They can't imagine God could be their friend. My prayer throughout the pages of this book has been to show you how much Jesus loves you and how much he loves the world. But until you choose to believe and receive his love, you'll attempt to face life alone. Jesus is the friend of sinners. He's the friend of anyone and everyone who will accept his offer of friendship. And to those who accept it, he gives us access to the Father and to heaven. It's one thing to agree mentally that Jesus wants to be the friend of sinners, but I think many of us disqualify ourselves before we even start that friendship. We assume that Jesus' friendship extends to everyone else, but since we know all the dirty details about ourselves, we assume we are excluded. Maybe we don't do this with ourselves, but instead we do it with others. Again, I've tried to paint a picture throughout this book of Jesus' heart to draw all people to himself. Regardless of their past, present, or future, we need to believe that even the people who seem furthest from God are deeply loved by him and are being drawn by him. And maybe we are the ones who will lead them to him if we are willing to be friends of sinners too. I want to end with one final story from the Bible that illustrates Jesus' passionate desire to befriend the world. Nowhere is this desire clearer than in the events surrounding his arrest and crucifixion. John chapter 13 records Jesus' last meal with his disciples. It was beautiful, moving moment, a time for his disciples to say goodbye to him. To this day, Christians everywhere remember the Last Supper when we participate in communion. At the end of the meal, though, something unexpected and seemingly out of place happened. Jesus insisted on washing everyone's feet. In that culture, foot washing was considered a lowly, menial task. It was completely illogical that Jesus would lower himself to such a level. Peter outright refused, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus pushed back, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." Verse 8. He went around the circle, serving every person in the room. Then he told them, "Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you." Verses 14 through 15. As we saw in the last chapter, Jesus is the greatest servant of all, and he asks us to serve one another as well. He was the friend of sinners, so he served sinners. Now he asks us to do the same. That's not the whole story, though. Have you ever stopped to realize Jesus even washed Judas's feet? Judas is the most famous traitor in human history. At this point in the narrative, he was already planning to betray Jesus. He was just waiting for the right moment. Jesus knew that, of course. He made several references to it during the meal, but he still washed Judas's feet. I can't imagine doing that. I think I would have broken Judas's feet, not washed them. I would have said, "Your feet stink, and so does your soul." I would have run him out of the room with a few choice words. Not Jesus. No matter who we are and what we've done or what we're planning to do, Jesus is committed to us. He is passionate about pursuing us, about capturing our hearts. But Judas was evil, you're probably thinking. He was a bad person. Yes, but Jesus stays the same. His love knows no end. Jesus doesn't just do love. Jesus is love. He can't stop loving because he can't deny himself. He pursues us even when his love has been betrayed. The height of Judas's evil only proves the depth of Jesus's love. Judas's scandalous betrayal only highlights Jesus's scandalous grace. The Bible is full of examples of God pursuing people who didn't deserve his love. He chased after people who had committed their worst mistakes imaginable because he is the friend of sinners, and that's what he does. He pursued Moses with a burning bush even after he murdered a man. He pursued Rahab with a scarlet cord even after she had been a prostitute. He pursued Gideon with an angel even after he had been terrified. He pursued David with a prophet from God even after he had committed adultery and murder. He pursued Jonah with a fish even after he disobeyed the word of the Lord. He pursued Lazarus with resurrection power even after he had been in the tomb for 4 days. He pursued Peter with beach breakfast even after he had denied him 3 times. He pursued Thomas with nail-scarred hands even after he had doubted him. He pursued Paul with a blinding light from heaven even after he had killed Jesus' followers. He pursued Judas by washing his feet even as his love was being betrayed. Do you realize the extent of Jesus' love for you? Can you see and believe his love for sinners, for the world, for humanity? Or do you think you are exception to his love, that your sins are too great, your love too weak, or your mistakes too many for Jesus to want you? Jesus is in hot pursuit of your heart. He is chasing you. Nothing you could do could change his passion for you. By the same token, he is passionate about others, even about the people we would tend to discount or disqualify. Jesus loves them. He wants you and me to reach out to them, to accept them, to befriend them. A few hours after the Last Supper, Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane with his disciples. He knew his time had come to be arrested. In the distance, he saw Judas and a crowd of soldiers and thugs coming toward him. Judas stepped forward to greet Jesus. He kissed him, which in that culture should have been a sign of friendship. But it wasn't this time. Judas had previously told the men with him, "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him." Matthew chapter 26, verse 48. At that moment, Jesus said something I still cannot comprehend. "Do what you came for, friend." Verse 50. Wait, what? Friend? Why would Jesus choose that term? He knew what was happening. He knew the rejection, the greed, the hatred in Judas's heart. He knew the pain that lay ahead as a result of his betrayal. And yet he still called Judas friend. Can you imagine what Judas felt when he heard that? "Jesus, you call me friend? Don't you know I'm betraying you? Don't you know I'm rejecting you? That doesn't make sense. You're supposed to hate me." It would end up being the last thing Jesus said to Judas. Less than 24 hours later, consumed with guilt, Judas committed suicide. Meanwhile, Jesus was led to the cross to die for the sins of humanity, the ultimate proof of his friendship with sinners. Jesus loved Judas all the way to the end, and he loves us with the same passion, the same constancy, the same commitment. His message of unconditional friendship to sinners is the foundation of our walk with him. I'm so glad our love for God doesn't dictate his love for us. Our love is fickle, but his love is faithful. Jesus pursued us when we were dead in our sins. He came to us. He convinced us of his love. He cleansed us and restored us. He will never give up on us. He will never stop loving us. He is the friend of sinners. And when we accept his friendship, his love, and his grace, we become friends for all eternity.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.